Welcome to Power Play, on a day when the right to block booze flowing across provincial boundaries was elevated to a Supreme Court case. We will find out what's at stake. Also coming up on today's show, the official opposition leader already has a long list of concerns after this cranky, polarized parliament's first week back after the Easter break. Ronna Ambrose is standing by. And the tough talk on trade by Trump was given a timely translation, say that five times real fast, before a parliamentary committee today. We will get the latest from the expert who was on the hot seat. And the great divide between Alberta and British Columbia could soon be coal if the BC Premier is reelected and follows through on her pledge to impose taxes or a ban on thermal coal. And we will find out what the impact that will have on Alberta's coal mining industry. But first, the House of Commons was in a toxic state today after just 1 week away back from their seats after the Easter break. Speaker Jeff Regan had to chastise MPs several times for heckling.
Mr. Speaker, the conservative rhetoric that simply doesn't match up the facts. After years of cuts, Mr. Speaker, and underspending, we are now in a troubling position where even the status quo of spending on defense will not even maintain the status quo of capability, Mr. Speaker. And our new defense policy is going to fix that, Mr. Speaker.
Order. It is the right and the duty of the official opposition to ask tough questions. But I hear from many Canadians who are unhappy with behavior in this House, particularly heckling. And I don't think the constituents of members, like that of the member for Cypress Hills Grasslands, from whom I have heard heckle 12 times already today, would really approve of that kind of behavior.
And Ron Ambrose joins me in the studio. Ms. Ambrose, a lot of heckling in the House, lots of toxicity. I mean, we've still got like 6 weeks to go before summer recess. You got scolded. Everyone got scolded by the speaker today. What's going on here?
There's a lot of passion in that place. People are angry. They're upset for really good reason. Out there, we have a lot of constituents that we represent. But right now, we're also being contacted by a lot of veterans, mm-hmm. a lot of people in the military, especially those that are serving currently don't feel comfortable going out speaking because, of course, they worry about the repercussions. And they're telling us that they've lost confidence in the Minister of Defense. And they're upset that all he's done is apologize. He actually hasn't even explained why he lied about his military service record and exaggerated his role. Mm-hmm. We didn't just exaggerate a role. He invented a role for himself as the architect of Operation Medusa when it wasn't true. He did it twice. And they're really upset about it. So, yes, our guys are upset, and they're loud, and they're calling for his resignation, and they're going to keep doing that until he steps aside, because look, he's in charge of our armed forces, making right. decisions about the kind of equipment they get, right. where they're deployed to, and they don't trust him anymore. So like one of our MPs said today, there's other people over there that have background in the military, so why don't we move him out and put somebody else in that can earn the trust of the men and women in uniform. And I think that's the right thing to do.
And he's now fudging a little bit on soldier pay and danger zones, right. saying he would, but now I guess there's caveats on who exactly is going to get it.
Well, this invention about his role, and it wasn't just a small lie. This was the largest battle that Canadians fought in Afghanistan. 12 Canadians died on the battlefield. And he said he was the architect of it. But he did it twice. Not just once, so it wasn't a mistake. But that's not the only thing. As you say, we have this issue with danger pay. He said that he gave it to them. Then he realized he hadn't, so he was going to give it back. Now there's still a problem with it. I think there's an issue of competence. There's an issue definitely of trust. Right. And this is only going to get worse. And I go back to another issue when he said repeatedly in the House of Commons that our allies not only were okay, they supported Canada pulling our CF-18 jets out of the fight against ISIS and our bombing missions. Right. When we knew that wasn't true, because President Obama and his defense secretary that same week said, actually, we'd like everyone to step up and do more bombing runs. We really need to degrade ISIS strength. And we pulled our jets out. And Mr. Trudeau and Mr. Sajjan said that, actually, they're happy that we did it. It's all good. And then we found out after, through diplomatic cables, and we never would have known if we didn't see that wasn't true also.
So you're not giving up, is what you're saying.
We're not going to give up because, look, these are the people that put their lives on the line for us, and they need to trust their leader.
Right.
And they don't anymore. So I said to him today, with where things are at, do you really think that with this situation, you're the best person in this job?
He didn't answer that, though.
No, of course he didn't. But the point is real, and it's important. I think they have to move him, or he has to step aside and let someone else do the job.
I do want to ask you, though, I mean, they're talking about this procedural change they're going to foist on the House about Trudeau only doing one question period per week, or taking all the questions in one question period per week. He could show up for more than one, I guess, if he wanted to. Yesterday, he did it again, took them all. How come that didn't work for you? It seems like you got an awful lot of questions in.
Sure. Well, he can ask. He can answer.
Not many answers.
He can answer any question, any time. But no, look at, as an opposition, we don't have the machinery of government. You know, we don't have the power of the government. And the tools that we have to do our jobs are in the House of Commons. And the way we hold the government to account is through debate and through question period. And all the tools that we have, he's trying to take away. And that's the tools we have and the work that we do makes our democracy function. And he's trying to take our tools away because he thinks that this place, Parliament, is an inconvenience. We can see it. I know he doesn't like question period. I know he doesn't like
Prime
coming.
Ministers don't usually like question period.
But just like every other Canadian, he has to do those parts of his job that he doesn't like. And look, he's the leader of the government in the House of Commons. So he should be proud to come every day and stand there and take questions on behalf of his government and their agenda. But that's not the case. You can tell he can't stand it. But guess what? That doesn't mean you get to change all the rules so that you get to come one day a week to work.
Ah, so we have a new control freak. No, I won't go there. And you got to say there was that one before. Never mind. I do want to ask about the fundraising situation. The Liberals have introduced these new fundraising rules. They open access. Media can go in. You know, people who are doing business with the government or lobbying the business government can't go. In fact, some were kicked out today, by the way, off the guest list today. Shouldn't all parties fall in line behind this? It seems like a fairly reasonable move.
Well, this is new for them, but not new for us. When we were in government, we followed those kinds of rules, and that's like why we didn't have these kinds of issues. The problem for the Liberals is when they got in, they started to do these cash for access like the Ontario Liberals do, which are illegal under the federal rules. And they just basically started to fundraise off of people that needed something from them. It's called stakeholder fundraising. We never did that. We followed the rules. And so they got in a lot of trouble for good reason. We'll see if they follow their new rules. They don't follow their own ethical rules. So I can't quite trust them to follow these. But look, you know, they're ministers. They have influence. They have power. He's the prime minister. Mr. Harper never did these kind of fundraisers. But they use Mr. Trudeau to do them. Why? Because people want to pay a lot of money to have access to him. So I personally think he shouldn't be doing any of them because it's just unseemly for the Prime Minister to be taking money from people that want access to him.
And Harper never did any of these fundraisers?
No.
There was never a public fundraiser? He said, come and meet the Prime Minister.
He did one fundraiser a year, and it was in his own riding, and it was like a Calgary barbecue. It was $120, and that was most of it went to pay for the steak. So no, he didn't, and because for that very reason, when you're the Prime Minister, you have a lot of power and influence, and you shouldn't be taking money for people to come see you. I think Canadians should feel they have access to their own Prime Minister, and they shouldn't have to pay $1,500 for it. So I guess we'll watch to see if they follow these rules, but...
You're not sounding too optimistic. All right, one final point, if I could. The Supreme Court of Canada is going to hear this ruling on interprovincial trade as it relates to alcohol.
Free the beer.
Free the beer.
Free the beer.
Does the Conservative Party support the idea of knocking down these limits?
Enough. No, just anecdotally, I was in a small brewery in Hamilton, Ontario, and these young guys started this brewery. You know, they hired a couple people. They started this small business. He won the award for the best beer in Canada. But he can't sell it outside of his own province.
It's crazy.
It was nuts because of these interprovincial barriers. So we're stopping these great breweries from being able to expand and grow and sell their product. They can't compete with these multinationals. And these breweries are popping up all over the country. Mm. And they're great small businesses in small towns especially. So yes, we are
Free
pushing.
The beer.
Hopefully the Supreme Court does the right thing and frees the beer.
All right. Ron Ambrose, always a pleasure having you in.
Thanks
for coming in. Appreciate that. All right. Let's continue that discussion. 100 years after the first Supreme Court ruling on the issue of free trade between provinces, the nation's top court As we said, we'll have another go at it over the case of booze bans. To discuss why this is important, we're joined from Calgary by Howard Anglin. He's executive director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation. All right, Howard, this is bigger than booze, but how?
Hello, Don. It's good to be on. Yes, it is potentially much bigger than booze. The case is about beer. And I just heard your previous guest, Ms. Ambrose, is absolutely right that our interprovincial trade barriers are a disgrace within Canada and hurting small businesses. But that applies beyond just alcohol. We have all sorts of provincial cartels and monopolies and regulations and restrictions that prevent people from selling products across Canada. And all of those are potentially at stake in this Supreme Court case.
Now, what's the economic potential here if we cleared away all these barriers, artificial barriers, and let everything roam free across Canada?
The potential is enormous. It would probably be the biggest economic boost to the Canadian economy since at least World War II. I've seen estimates from $50 billion a year in additional GDP to up to $130 billion a year. And so even if you take a median number there, the benefits would be significantly larger than any free trade agreement Canada signed outside of Canada.
Wow, that's interesting. So I guess I'm confused. If it's good for the economy and consumers would benefit, why aren't premiers and the prime minister just piling on to get on board with this?
Well, it's the old story about protectionism. And so instead of having the free trade that the framers of our Constitution, fathers of Confederation, envisioned, we have premiers who are protecting their turf, trying to allow as little access to their own markets while trying to negotiate as much possible access to each other's markets, just like in international free trade agreements. The difference here is our original Constitution, the Constitution Act of 1867, contains a provision that makes it very clear that provinces have to admit free goods from other provinces. And for 96 years, provinces have been ignoring that.
I mean, you were in the Harper PMO. Were you banging your head against the wall trying to get provinces to lower these barriers when you were there?
Well, it was certainly something that our government took up. If I can take off my nonpartisan hat as the executive director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation, it's an issue that multiple governments have taken on. I know James Moore made it a priority when he was a minister of industry, and I'm sure it frustrates people in the current Liberal government as well.
I am curious. I mean, you rightly pointed out this government tends to be fixated on trying to get free trade deals. Europe, they're talking to China, they're talking about Japan. I mean, I find it incredible that they're not more aggressive on the internal trade side of things, given they've had almost a year and a half to get this ball moving.
There's an interesting historical irony here. When Canada was formed, when Confederation came into being 150 years ago, the Fathers of Confederation were very careful to ensure that Canada be a single economic unit. That's why they wrote it right into the Constitution Act of 1867. And the reason at the time was the United States was going through one of its spasms of protectionism, which happened every generation or two, in the wake of the Civil War. And Canadian businesses were about to lose access to the American market. There was something called the Reciprocity Agreement back then, which was the old free trade agreement between Canada or the British colonies and the American government. And the Canadian Fathers of Confederation wanted to make sure that Canadian businesses, if they lost access to the American market, at least had access to the widest possible market within Canada. And that's why they made sure that there could be no internal trade barriers. So here we are, fast forward 150 years. America is going through another protectionist spasm. And Canadian premiers and the prime minister are going down to Washington and sending envoys to ensure that the American government recognizes the benefits, the reciprocal benefits of free trade. Yet somehow that logic is lost as soon as we come back to Canada and we tolerate a deep balkanization of our own economy.
Very quickly, Howard, do you believe we'll be raising a glass to toast free trade and liquor after this verdict comes in?
I do believe that. If the Supreme Court is faithful to the text of the Constitution and the intent of the framers, then absolutely, it will be a huge victory for Canadians, not just beer drinkers, but I'm happy to join you in a glass of beer.
All right. I'll drink to that as well, Howard. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
So will I. Thank you very much, Don.
Coming up, we'll look at the latest moves by the governing Liberals to clean up their fundraising act. Our MPs are standing by. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, it's the return of the Thursday MPs, fresh and eager to get along, crossing all party lines after a couple weeks getting recharged in their ridings. Meet the happy gang. Ruby Sahota is a Liberal MP. Marilyn Gladue is a Conservative MP. Rachel Blaney is an NDP MP. Welcome.
Yeah. Nice. Drop the gloves, come out fighting.
No, nice to be back.
It is hectic up in the House. I was talking to Ron Ambrose. I don't know if it's just the Sagin thing or the reforms that the opposition parties are finding particularly difficult to accept. Rachel, I'll start with you. Why is it so testy?
I mean, I think it's a cumulative effect of a lot of things that are happening. I think the opposition has been very clear that we're concerned about the unilateral decision-making that the Liberals are making around changing how we're going to do business in the House. And then we have this issue with the defense minister, where there's a lot of concern about, you know, we accept the apology, but the answers are not being forthcoming. We're waiting for them, and people are frustrated. They want to hear those things, and we need to see some accountability, and we're not getting answers from the government right now.
Is that it, Marilyn? You just don't get answers?
Absolutely. There are no answers happening, and there's a lot of lying happening in the House. And I think, you know, especially with the Minister of Defense, he's lost all credibility with the armed forces and needs to step down. And so that's part of why the temperature in the House is going up, and, you know, people's talking points aren't helping the situation at all.
What's he lying? What's all a lying? He's apologized every time he opens his mouth.
He's misrepresented the facts on numerous occasions, not just with respect to, you know, his role in the Afghanistan mission, but also with withdrawing the CF-18s. Today in the House, Ronna Ambrose stood with a piece of paper talking about the danger pay. And it was clear that his story keeps changing on this one as well. So from a credibility point of view, he's lost the trust of the people in the military, and he needs to step down.
Sunny ways, Ruby. I don't know.
I don't believe the conservatives were known for giving, you know, the complete full answers either. Answers are being given, but you can't even hear them in the House. I sit there. It's appalling what's happening right now. You can see it. People who are there, school students, were up in the gallery today, and I saw the look on their faces, and they're shocked beyond disbelief, because most of the shouting is coming from the Conservative Party at this time, and it's antics.
Except for Marilyn, of course. She would never.
Well, I am the most collegial, and Ruby and
she won the most collegial
award. Together before.
Talk about Sagin here. The defense minister, he's apologized more times than I can count, but he doesn't really answer the question anymore.
Right.
He just sort of defaults to, you know, our 10-year record of lousy spending and priorities by the Conservatives, and we're looking to correct the problem. I mean, he's never really explained to everyone's satisfaction, like, why he did what he did. He says he wants to own the mistake, but doesn't explain how he's going to own the mistake.
He has fully explained it on his social media.
Where
there's
an
explanation there. Recently, you can take a listen to Chris Vernon, the chief of staff's interview that he gave, which described him as a critical player and a part of the design team. Mm-hmm. So at this point, I think, you know, with the apology coupled with a lot of explanation from, you know, people who were heavily involved in that Operation Medusa, we need to accept the apology, which some are saying that they do. But obviously, from what we see in the House, I don't think that's the behavior of those that accept an apology and want to move on with talking about important issues that affect Canadians.
Well, but realistically, Rachel, how long can you keep shooting at this guy? You know, he basically isn't going to change his mind. The Prime Minister isn't going to fire him. Is this productive use of the House of Commons? Question period.
Well, I think when you have so many Canadians standing up and saying, where are those answers? And we want to hear those answers in a meaningful way. And now we see that the inquiry to the Afghan detainees has been totally shut down. We're calling on the Ethics Commissioner to get back to this, because how can it be a gold mine of information one day and then now he knows absolutely nothing? There is just too many questions. And there are too many questions. And Canadians know that. And that's why they are calling for action.
Well, to be fair, the minister said he'd go back before it.
Are calling for his resignation. Well, men and women that have to trust him, you know, when they put their lives on the line, they're calling for it.
I haven't seen one person in uniform stand up there and say that, though.
Well, they're afraid to stand up because
absolutely.
They're afraid of the repercussions.
And you don't speak for all the men and women in uniform. So I believe this is an attempt to embarrass Minister Sajjan, and he is a decorated war hero. He has served over 25 years in the Army
and
Reserve.
Nobody's arguing that
record.
Just the fact that as a Liberal politician, he's been misleading Canadians.
He was a part of the design
issues.
Team. This operation would not have happened without him. Listen to the words of Chris Vernon, the chief of staff of the operation.
All right. Fundraising season is kicking off for the Liberals again tonight. Remember, we had that whole pay for access controversy, and they've rejigged the rules. So tonight, it'll reopen in Montreal. It'll be open. Media can go there. The public can go. Anyone can go. There's no membership card required. It seems to me the act's somewhat cleaned up, but I gather maybe not entirely. Rachel, what's wrong with what they've done? Isn't that the way all fundraising should be done?
You know, I think every Canadian wants to see a lot of accountability. And we have a prime minister that admitted that he discussed things during a fundraiser that he shouldn't have. That hasn't really been followed up with. We also know that there's a fee to this. It's a $250 fee. And I can tell you, the members of my riding, North Island Powell River, that's a significant amount of money. So it's also about questioning those things, about the reality of the prime minister having a lot of power and the ministers having a lot of power. So when they're inviting people, they're paying $250, they're getting some information and they're sharing things, and I think we have to question those.
$250 and go? You can get some information.
You know what? This is the problem with cash for access. It's preferential access to the government, and they haven't fixed the problem by fixing these rules, because people are still paying money to talk about government business at Liberal fundraisers and get what they want. That's the problem.
I'd like to see some of the other parties step up and make these changes as well.
Other parties never had these problems.
We don't know, do we? Because their fundraisers aren't open.
I don't recall Harper doing it, but maybe I'm wrong.
Tomorrow, Miss Rona could have $1,000 per ticket dinner, and no one would know. No one would know who would be invited. So I think
she's not going to approve a bank. She doesn't have the power to approve $1 billion in health care. She doesn't have a power to appoint ports of authority.
This is a great step forward, I believe.
They already had to kick lobbyists out.
That's
tonight.
Right.
Like they already say, that's simply a lobbyist. You can't commit.
Yeah, and they're in reaction to some things that we saw just happen a few months ago that we knew were not okay. And so, you know, this is their way of trying to say, oh, we're all good now. Look at the magic hands. Everything is fine. Wow. I think there's going to be more questions. We're going to see more things come up. And at the end of the day, it's still a $250 bill to walk in that door. And when you look at some of the reports I've been reading about housing, you know, we have people who are homeless right now who cannot give information in the so-called consultation of the Liberal government because they don't have access to even a computer. So let's look at what consultation is, and let's look what fundraising is, and make sure that
we're
accountable.
It's absolutely great that so many people want to meet this prime minister, and he has been holding open town halls all across the country. That's been unprecedented of any prime minister before. So there are many opportunities to meet the prime minister, and the fact that these lobbyists have been kicked out, that's great. It's a great first step to openness and transparency, and that's exactly what this government's doing.
Very quickly, I want to end on another story. The government, the previous government, unleashed audits against charities to make sure that they were doing political advocacy, but not more than about 10% of their activities were devoted to that. And some people thought that put advocacy chills throughout the charity sector. Today, the Minister of the Revenue Canada, or Canadian Revenue Agency, said stopped, even though 12 have been done, and I think 7 have been found. They should have their status revoked. I think that's the number. Anyway. You know, Rachel, you came from the nonprofit sector.
I certainly
did. Does this
sound
like the right step?
I think it is the right step, and I'm going to be happy to give a compliment to this government on that. You know, the reality is it did silence nonprofits. And you look at the work that nonprofits and charities do in communities, and they make huge impact with what they do. So making sure that they're not silenced, they need to be able to speak up. And, you know, I represented a nonprofit that didn't make significant amount of money. Being able to stand up and say the things that were impacting us was so important, and we were really silenced.
They make a mistake in the last government, and this has been corrected?
You know what? The problem that they were trying to address was political activists hiding as charitable organizations and doing work really on behalf of governments, which was not a level playing field. And so it disturbs me to see that 6 of the 30 that they audited did have their status, given up, and 7 of the last 12 that were in the process of being audited were going to have their charitable status retracted. And so that tells me there is a problem there, and we don't want to see political activists doing that. Now they've taken the 10% rule and said you could use your whole budget. This is not a good idea.
This is about fairness. Just because you don't agree with the political activists, you don't agree with the charities, doesn't mean you can threaten them with audits. That's what this is about. So we need to bring fairness back, and charities need to be able to advocate on behalf of the people that they work with.
There was money being funneled from the U.S. into political activism in Canada.
Well, that's gonna
none of that's been found, so I think this is a good step forward.
Thank you. Appreciate y'all coming
somewhat
in.
Somewhat happy ending.
Yeah, right? Sort of a sunny ending.
Back to the house.
All right, get back in there and start fighting again. Thanks, you all. We'll see you next week. Coming up, a parliamentary committee held a hearing into Canada-U.S. relations today. We'll talk to a key witness from Washington for the latest in trade tensions. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, there's more confusion than clarity in Canada-U.S. trade relations as the Trump administration moves between nixing and negotiating on NAFTA. Our expert on the file is Scotty Greenwood of the Canadian-American Business Council. She appeared before a parliamentary committee studying the issue today. That means she's in Ottawa instead of your usual Washington. It's nice to have you here in person.
Thank you.
You look even better in person, if that's possible. I don't know what your message was to there. There's a lot of jitters in Canada about what the heck's going on. Were you able to calm those jitters, or are you going to make the jitters even worse?
I don't know. You'll have to ask them if anybody was made to feel better or worse. I actually had the opportunity to talk to two different committees today, which is good. Efficient, two for one, for one trip. You know, this president is amazing because he somehow has figured out how to get credit for the status quo. Right? The status quo was going to be we're going to do a new NAFTA, but by saying we're going to pull out, everybody worried. And now when he said we're going to renegotiate, people breathe a sigh of relief. It's too soon to breathe a sigh of relief, Don, because there are a lot of issues going on. And we just outlined the things that we think are worth focusing on as we go through whatever this grand negotiation is.
All right, so what is worth in NAFTA? I mean, we all forget this softwood lumber dispute and the supply management of the dairy. That's not even part of NAFTA. This is outside of that.
That has never been part of it, although we saw Secretary Ross say last week that everything is related to everything. So I think everybody's putting the kitchen sink into the negotiation. We think it's really important to do several things. You've got to update the NAFTA for the digital economy. It was written 23 years ago before we had one. You've got to deal with intellectual property protection. That's something that's been a big part of the courts for a number of years, but the Parliament needs to look at IP protection for innovation. You've got to look at regulatory harmony. You know, that's a really important element of how our two countries do business together that needs to get better. And then finally, you've got to deal with labor mobility. You've got to get people more easily back and forth across the border in a way that reflects how our economies truly work. Whether it's trilateral or bilateral, I don't know yet.
Yeah.
But that's the other piece.
That's what I always wonder. Like, the clock's ticking on the Mexican elections. Like,
absolutely.
This seems to be the driving force. I got to get going by, I don't know, by summer at the latest.
Right.
So is it possible they'll just go, ooh, there's an election underway. We're not going to get into the lame duck negotiating with Mexico. We'll just do a bilat between Canada and the U.S. and cut them out?
That's absolutely possible. And then the U.S. would have a separate bilateral agreement with Mexico. I don't think that's anybody's preference, nobody's first choice, but if the politics require it, so be it. The issues with respect to Mexico are really different than the issues with respect to Canada. The commercial issues are basically the same, how business does business with each other, the supply chains. But, you know, on Mexico, you've got a lot of drug trafficking collaboration. You've got the wall, of course, which has to be built.
Yeah.
I heard he said he's going to build a wall. So the issues are really different. And that might change the speed at which the U.S. is able to negotiate. But again, hopefully it'll be trilateral. We'll see. There's a lot of time. You know, anything could change in a day, as you know.
Well, I guess the possibility of nixing NAFTA's still there, or do you believe that's just the bluster, the art of the deal guy wheeling and dealing and saying, I'll pull it if you don't give me what I want, but that's not an option?
It is posturing, but he also could do it. Right? This is somebody who was elected to flip the table. You know, he wasn't elected to set the table to, you know, have polite conversation on policy issues. He's going to break the place up. He's going to drain the swamp. And if that requires pulling out a NAFTA, so be it. I think he realizes that it's against U.S. interest to do that.
Uh-huh.
It wouldn't bother him if it's against somebody else's interest because he's putting America first, as he's said. But we're so interlinked and intertwined that even his own cabinet, Sonny Perdue, the new Secretary of Agriculture, comes with a an infographic about how if you get out of NAFTA, that hurts American farmers. That's something that resonated with President Trump, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard these great statistics about 35 states have Canada, their number one export. We heard John McCain say, rip up NAFTA, Arizona goes into bankruptcy, or the Deep South goes into bankruptcy.
Right.
Surely Trump hears from these people, doesn't he?
He's getting there. Yes, that's right.
He's going to come around that NAFTA is not the evil, worst deal in American history kind of thing he's always said?
Well, you know, again, he's all about posturing. So he's going to set out an extreme position and then negotiate back. But he's also hearing from dairy farmers. He's hearing from Paul Ryan in Wisconsin.
He reacts like a crazy. I mean, he just reacts instantly. He reads a headline and he goes, oh, let's fix that problem.
Yes, he does.
How do you deal with that?
Welcome to my world.
Well, thank you for coming to our world. Scotty, it's always a pleasure having you, and it's nice seeing you here in the studio.
It's good to be with you, as always.
Talk to you soon, I'm sure.
Okay.
All right, coming up, BC's premier is planning and pushing a ban or a tax on thermal coal being exported from the province. We'll find out the impact on neighboring Alberta's coal industry next. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, there's a nasty lump of coal in the BC election campaign's promises that has neighboring Alberta concerned. BC Premier Christy Clark wants to ban coal from passing through BC to export markets in retaliation for boosted softwood lumber duties in the U.S. Robin Campbell is president of the Coal Association of Canada. He joins us via FaceTime from Edmonton. Robin, it sounds like your industry could be collateral damage with BC picking a fight in the U.S. over the softwood lumber war. How would that ban or a tax impact your coal as it heads west for export?
Well, I think, Don, you know, it's definitely going to be a serious challenge for us, especially with a $70 a ton carbon tax when coal sells for about $90. So, you know, we're looking at job losses in Alberta. We're also looking at job losses in British Columbia, people that work on the railways, people that work in the ports. This isn't just going to affect Alberta jobs, but also affect BC jobs.
I correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a free trade deal between Alberta and BC. So can she actually do this?
Well, when you look at the New West Partnership that was signed between Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and Alberta a few years ago, actually when Premier Stelmach was the premier and actually spearheaded this, I mean, that was set up to reduce trade barriers and to have free flow of goods between the three provinces to make sure that, you know, Western Canada could become an economic hub in North America. And this is everything that she's doing goes against the spirit of that deal.
Well, never mind that. Also, as I was reading it as well, the ports are a federal responsibility. Is she not overstepping provincial bounds with that?
I would say she is. We've written letters, industries letters to the Prime Minister and to various of his cabinet. We're waiting to hear a response back on that. But we believe that she hasn't got the grounds to do what she's doing. But just the fact that she'd even try to do that, you know, causes us concern, and it should cause anybody that's shipping product through the coast of British Columbia concern.
I'm curious. I mean, she's aiming at the United States with this. Does the U.S. ship a lot of coal through, like, Vancouver and stuff, or is it mostly Alberta that's doing that?
No, we have about 6 to 7 million tons of thermal coal coming out of the United States to go through the ports in British Columbia.
Oh, I see. Okay, well, I guess never mind irritating Alberta on this. Isn't she picking a fight with Trump?
Well, you know, she's picking a fight with Trump. She's picking a fight with the governors of various states in the West that depend on the coal industry as one of their major employers. You know, so there's going to be a lot of people that have an interest in this. And at the end of the day, you know, I just don't see her being able to do what she wants to do.
I gather the NDP's not totally opposed either. What's your next step? How do you fight this?
Well, again, we've written letters to the Prime Minister. We think a federal jurisdictional issue, in the sense that the federal government owns the ports. You know, the largest commodity shipped through the ports is actually coal, and you know, that's a lot of money to the federal government. And as I said, it creates good paying jobs in British Columbia and in Alberta. You know, the average coal miner is making about $100,000 a year. People working on the railways are making, you know, in excess of $100,000 a year. People working in the ports are making good money. So these are jobs, these are good paying jobs that are going to be lost. And it's going to, you know, cause some real issues with our industry and with the you know, the economics of both Alberta and British Columbia. And again, you know, I was listening to the lady you had on earlier. Do you really want to poke Trump? I mean, you know, I mean, it's one thing to talk in a certain manner, but you know, this is a gentleman that is in control of our largest trading partner, and he's not. It's not the time to be poking him right now, I don't think.
Okay, we'll see what happens. The election underway. I think the election's on Monday, so we'll see what happens after that. All right, Robin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Don. Take care of yourself.
Coming up, my last word on why the Supreme Court needs to free the beer from interprovincial hiccups, and there's probably only one journalist with plenty of Prince Philip interaction, and that's our Craig Oliver, the gallery's most senior journalist, shares his memories of the royal who has visited Canada more than any other. That's coming up after these messages. Welcome back. Well, there may be a generation gap between them, so our Thursday Press Gallery guests have covered the entire spectrum in Canadian politics. CTV's political commentators Craig Oliver, Bill Curry, writes for the Globe and Mail. You know, I'm starting to feel a little sorry for Minister Sajjan. It's been 4 days of nonstop pummeling and question period, but should I feel sorry for him, Craig?
Well, no. He didn't make a mistake. He lied. And this is going to hurt his credibility. But as for the Defense Department, this could turn out to be the best thing that ever happened to them. Because now Sajjan absolutely has to deliver on the defense review. And yesterday he made a big long speech about how underfunded, tried to blame the Tories, and they're not the only ones to blame. In fact, the Tories did make some big purchases. But he made the speech about how they were going to correct it. Absolutely, he was going to correct this massive underfunding in the military, which is terrible, which I've said on this show many times. At midnight, with the shades drawn, generals will tell you it's awful. Mm. They are lack of funding. We haven't got the money to do the jobs we need to do. Anyway, he's going to have to deliver now. He's going to have to deliver with a lot of money to the Defense Department and relatively soon, and make some big promises that the government's going to have to keep. Otherwise, he's going to become the architect of his own disaster as far as those in the Defense Department are concerned. So I think this is going to be very interesting in the next... They're now 5 months late, he is, 5 months late with his defense white paper. He's going to have to deliver on it soon, and he's going to have to pony up.
Yeah, Bill, but where's the money to pony up coming from? I don't think I saw it in the budget.
No, exactly. There's a real murkiness going on around with defense spending. It's such a huge item in the budget. So, you know, a little bit up and down the defense budget has a big impact to the Ottawa's overall bottom line. There was kind of whispers before the budget that there wouldn't be money in the budget, but it would come later in this defense policy renewal that Craig was talking about. But in the budget, not only was there no new money, there was over $8 billion reprofiled off into the future. So whatever announcement's coming, how does that reflect this already, this reprofiling we saw in the budget? Like, politically, what's interesting is, I mean, you've got this minister, Sajjan, who's having a hard time. Normally, ministers kind of disappear for a little while when they're having a hard time, but the government needs him to be front and center. The NATO summit's coming up. It's Donald Trump's probably his first foreign trip, so it's going to be a big international event. And Trump is pressuring Canada, like in other countries, to spend 2% of GDP on defense. Well, we're only at 1%, so that's an extra $20 billion that Canada does not have at all for
what
defense
spending. What happens, Craig, if we go to that NATO summit empty-handed?
Well, that will be also important to see. But he may not be empty-handed if he can make promises that the money is coming, that the Defense Department's going to get the kind of funding it requires. But it'll depend on the strategic picture, where he's going to put the money. That'll be what those in uniform will want to see. But the one other aspect of this that needs to be said, and that is he has had a great record as a soldier up to now and as a policeman. And I think it's worth something. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's worth giving this guy a chance. So I think the Prime Minister made the right decision not to pull him.
Yeah, he doesn't. It's past the point where they'd throw him out of the cabinet job if he was that troubled. But from this issue, wouldn't he be, Bill?
Well, I mean, we do see there is this pattern. Sometimes when ministers are in trouble, you wait until there's a summer cabinet shuffle and you move things around. So governments are, you know, things have to be really bad for somebody to be fired at the height of a controversy. So if they feel at the next cabinet shuffle it's an issue, then that's probably when they would deal with it.
All right. You've written a story about the Infrastructure Bank. Please stay with us, people. It's not that boring. It's very important, and Bill's going to tell us why. Why should we care that the people are starting to question this Infrastructure Bank, and no lesser lights than Kevin Page, the former Parliamentary Budget Officer?
Yeah, this is a big new way of delivering infrastructure. They're putting $35 billion into this thing. It's supposed to be up and running this year. And Justin Trudeau's made it a big priority. He's speaking to international investors all around the world, trying to get them to be involved in this. The issue, though, is people are not entirely convinced of the logic behind it. So Kevin Page at the University of Ottawa and his team, they say, like, there still has not been a cohesive argument for why working with these investors who are going to want 8 or 9% return on their investment is better than just, you know, using it the old-fashioned way with government debt. So that's the tension. Governments don't want more debt on their books because it's bad politics, but there's a price to pay for going this other way.
Okay.
Well, it's a great capitalist idea, but I'm not sure it's such a great idea as progressive economics. So, for instance, if I'm going to invest in this, I'm going to invest in the lowest risk investment at the highest possible return.
All right.
And the government gets at what's left over. And that could, taxpayers could suffer in that, for sure. So, and the government, remember, can get loans because it's the government, no risk in not being paid off, at an incredibly low rate.
Right.
Canada's GDP ratio. It's still, debt to GDP ratio is still just about the lowest in the G7. So I'm not sure that Canadians are sold on why we need this bank.
So what's been happening in the House the last couple of days is the debate on the budget bill. And this bill to create the Infrastructure Bank is actually a piece of the budget bill. So there is no standalone debate where the MPs can call people from around the world to figure out how this could be done. So that gets into the whole issue of an omnibus bill and why you don't get to study things in depth.
All right, I care, I think, a little bit. All right, Prince Philip, the partner of Queen Elizabeth, is stepping back from all public duties. Craig, you've met this gentleman. You know, it shouldn't be surprising. He's 95 years old,
well,
I guess.
I think it's regretful that he has to retire early.
Yeah, he was a big friend of Canada, though, wasn't he?
Well, absolutely, but of all the Commonwealth. But I think he liked Canada a lot. He's a curmudgeonly kind of guy, very direct, almost raw in his directness and his outspokenness. Mm-hmm. So I met him three times, but one really intimate event in the Arctic on the 1970 tour of the Arctic by the royal family. We were stuck for 24 hours. I think it was in Tuktoyaktuk, I can't remember. But anyway, the weather was so bad, nobody could leave. There was absolutely nothing to do, no programs on. And so the royal family organized an event with the media, and there weren't very many of us. Mm-hmm. So we had them sort of on our own for quite a long time. I remember he said one thing that I thought was really smart. Some of the reporters, maybe myself, said a lot of Canadians don't want the royal family, the Queen, to be the head of state. Yeah. And he said, well, if you don't want us, we don't want to be here. It's your decision, not our decision. I don't want to be here. The Queen doesn't want to be here. If you don't want us, just let us know.
All right.
And we'll leave with the best will in the world.
All right. Thanks, Craig. Always a
you're welcome.
History in walking, talking history book. All right, it's time for my last word. All right, almost within sight of Parliament Hill on the Quebec side of the river, there's a slightly shabby but always busy store where a law now headed for the Supreme Court is broken dozens of times every day. Hundreds of cases of cheap suds and wine pour out of Beer King and Gatineau into the open trunks of party planning buyers from Ottawa. Not that I'm an illegal importer of Beer King product, because I always get someone else to do it, but the savings from a Quebec booze purchase can exceed $10 per case, which makes it particularly economical to buy it in thirst-quenching bulk. Combined with the area's Costco, it's one of the biggest smuggling operations in Canada, and it's hidden in plain sight. Anyone bringing more than a couple cases of beer or a dozen bottles of wine across the Ottawa River is breaking the law, and this isn't a one-off. Free-flowing trade in beer, wine, and spirits stops at all provincial boundaries except Alberta and Manitoba. So it's with considerable relief we learned today that our constitutional right to challenge provincial liquor and beer retailing monopolies through interprovincial competition is headed to the Supreme Court for its final showdown. This hearing was driven by a New Brunswick man who decided the quota law was an ass and openly imported more than his allowable limit from Quebec. It was a deliberate provocation, and it worked like a charm. Now heading into the legal realm from where there is no further appeal, the justices have the power to undo a nation's entire history of erecting artificial barriers to shelter government-run retailers which engage in gouging consumers. Let's hope the court sides with common sense and the Constitution, because this supposedly free trade-crazed federal government specifically excluded alcohol from last month's open border agreement. The Prime Minister and the Premiers need a legal kick in the pants to avoid the very real possibility that legalized marijuana will beat booze to free travel across provincial lines. But until common sense prevails, Beer King and others like it will be a retail kingdom for bargain hunters who see a ridiculous law that's driving them to drink and don't really care if the suds come from another province. That's the last word, and that's it for today's Political Power Plays. Marla Fernandez is standing by with the latest news headlines. Thanks for watching the broadcast or listening to our podcast. Here's how you can reach us with show reactions and ideas. We're back tomorrow with all the big moves from Parliament Hill across the country and around the world. Hoping to join us again at this time on CTV News Channel.